You are listening to Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast. This is episode 15 for Tuesday, March 22nd of 2022. JJ Sefton here with CBD and a very, very special guest. Let me see if I can find his wonderful biography. Here it is, Harry Stein. He's a contributing editor right now to City Journal and is the author of many, many books, including The Magic Bullet, Infinity's Child, and more relevantly, How I Accidentally Joined the Vast Right-Wing Conspiracy and Found Inner Peace, as well as No Matter What, They'll Call This Book Racist, How Our Fear of Talking Honestly About Race Hurts Us All, and his most recent ones, Will Tripp, Pissed Off Attorney at Law, and Why We Won't Talk Honestly About Race. Gentlemen, welcome Harry Stein. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Pleasure to be here. And by the way, those two race books were one and the same. I got so little attention, including on the conservative press. They were so scared of the original title, No Matter What, They'll Call This Book Racist, that I stupidly decided to change the paperback into something far more innocuous, which was a big mistake. And I regret it. But in any case, yeah, it's the same book, essentially.
You know, it's really funny.
It appeared pre-Trayvon Martin, so I got to add the Trayvon Martin thing to the paperback.
Well, it's funny we talk about that, and I think just before we went on the air, we were talking about the fact that, you know, the Babylon Bee just got banned for basically discussing the truth, and on Twitter, just by saying the truth, that this Leah Thomas woman is it Rachel Levine or whatever, they're not women, they're men, and then that was, you know, an effrontery to the sensibilities of the powers that be. But they don't care, they didn't back down from it. So there's kind of a lesson there, I guess.
Well, I mean, actually, the statement was very, very strong. I mean, I'm a contributor to or a subscriber to Babylon Bee, so I got the notice, and then of course I was reading about it in the Post just now as well. And they're tough. I mean, Twitter was perfectly willing to have them back if they deleted that post. Twitter could have deleted it themselves, as they pointed out, but no, they needed them to come on bended knee. They needed them to essentially recognize the supreme power of the woke, and they refused to do that. And that's an important lesson. And you know, I think a lot of people learned early on the worst path to go when you're accused of something like this is try to apologize or accommodate these people. They can't be accommodated. They're totalitarians, and they have to be dealt with as such.
Absolutely. And the sad thing is that the track record for the left is essentially perfect. Every time they demand that some organization or some person bend the knee, and that person bends the knee and accepts accepts that method of contrition, they're beaten to death. Literally, no, although sometimes yes. And I think the lesson is very, very clear. You can never apologize. You can never back down. Say, screw you. You don't like what I said? Refute it. But the, you know, acquiescence to the liberal, I'm sorry, not the liberal can't, the left-wing can't is something that the right does far too often and fails every single time.
Yeah, I mean, there is really no understanding of who these people on the other side are. I actually haven't grown up as a child of communists, had kind of a sense of it all along. And it was actually party to it for quite a few years, certainly through college and into my early adulthood. So I absolutely understand the mentality of these people. I mean, you know, they were calling people fascists who disagreed with them when I was a kid. And there was always that level of intolerance. The difference now is it's been empowered by not only the traditional left, our corporate America, and the media.
The anti-fascists were, that was a term that I recall from reading about the history of the Communist Party in the 20s, anti-fascism. So it's nothing new. You know, the smart thing that the left does is that they recycle tried and true techniques. And the dumb thing the right does is forget. Unfortunately, it's biting us on the ass right now.
Beyond forgetting, they just accept it. They accept the meme, and they accept the narrative of what is put out before them by the left. And we should just, the first thing you should do is whenever you get into an argument with these people, just look, I reject your premise completely. This is not the way it is, and so on and so forth, and just let the chips fall where they may. But to just accept it and to argue on their terms, you've already lost the battle, in my opinion. But Harry, I wanted to circle back because you mentioned, and I know your story because we've been friends for many years and work together, but you grew up as actually a child of, you know, I wouldn't say communist, but very, very left-wing family. And yet you sort of found your way to see the light, so to speak. How did that,
How did that manifest itself? How did you?
First off, it's very generous of you to say not exactly communist. Yes, exactly. Communist.
Oh, okay. comrade father. Okay.
And actually, by no means ashamed of. I of course grew up during a fanatically anti-communist period of American life during the 50s and 60s. So my parents were quiet about it. And frankly, by then, they'd moved into kind of mainstream democratic politics. On the left side, my mother was a huge Stevenson supporter. This is my parents' history. They met, they were first-generation Jews in New York, where, as has been observed, if you were on the far right, you were a socialist. In their neighborhood, there was no such thing as a Republican, or even really kind of a moderate Democrat. So my father would told me about his uncle was actually considered right wing. He was a socialist. and the big joke in the family, which my father as a small child thought was hilarious, was the left is never right. And but as my parents grew up, my father was born in 1912, my mother in 1913. So by the time the Depression rolled around, my father was in City College, which was, of course, a very left-wing school. My mother was always kind of sentimentally of the left. And the Communist Party was very effective in recruiting young people then. All of their friends were communists. I interviewed my parents actually many, many years ago and recently listened to those tapes, which I did when I was in my early 20s and was thinking of writing a book, a pro-communist book, called Saving the World Together. It's going to be an oral history of the Communist Party. And among other things, I discovered they were far higher up in the party than I had realized. My father is kind of the head of the whole Bronx section.
Well,
my mother.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, they were big communists.
I'm sure he knew my grandfather.
It's the same thing, huh?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm a few years younger than you are, but I'm the grandson of communists.
Yeah.
To my grandfather's credit, when he discovered the reality of Stalinist Russia, the Stalinist Soviet Union, he forcefully pushed back against the communists, and he ended his life as I would call him a soft socialist. But in the 30s, and probably late 20s, early 30s, he was a physician in the Bronx, and it's very possible that he knew your father.
Very possible he treated my father. My father also told a story about breaking his leg, and the physician who lived directly above them, who was a sympathizer, took care of him. And it was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful man for this. But who knows? But yeah, I mean, I used to ask my father in particular, once I'd moved to the right, how they could have, you know, countenanced the purges. And he said, well, you know, we really didn't know. We thought it was reactionary propaganda. And but what about Stalin? I mean, Stalin was clearly a murderous tyrant. You must have known that. He had that cute little mustache. My father was a comedy writer. So he made it into a joke. But, you know, it's really beyond me, except that it was their religion, as people say. It gave them a lot of purpose in life. My father was actually in show business, so could have been blacklisted, was not. He actually, at the time, prior to becoming a writer, he worked as a social worker. So in the period he might have been implicated, he actually was not in show business, which is how he escaped. But his first job he had was actually writing for Zero Mostel, who was a very active communist when Mostel was doing radio in the late 40s, or the mid to late 40s. And they met at a kind of communist dinner with other communist friends. And, you know, every one of their friends, the whole circle was communist. I mean, when I was a kid, I remember people coming to our house to escape being subpoenaed.
I was going to say, at the dinner, the food must have been horrible in such small portions.
Well, the thing, I mean, these were the people who really formed, certainly on the comedy side, the Hollywood system. I mean, this guy who was a really nice guy was one of the creators of Gomer Pyle and Mayberry RFD. I mean, that's who he was. The Andy Griffith Show. He was, I'm sure he too at that point was no longer active, but they were all still on the left.
And yet somehow you made this segue into normalcy, or at least saw the light of, you know, you're like, my God, what was all this? What was that? What was that moment, that thing?
Well, it's interesting. I'll go back a little ways, because in college, I think this was certainly true where I went to school. And I think it was true in many cases. The people who really were furthest on the left on many college campuses were red diaper babies. We'd grown up it, by the time we got to, I started college in the fall of 66, I'd already participated in lots of demonstrations against the war. And basically I was at a kind of apolitical campus, and we turned it around so fast because most people are essentially followers, and it very quickly became hip and the best way to get laid. And everyone kind of followed that lead. But I remained on the left my early years in journalism. Actually, I went from college to journalism school at Columbia, and basically this was 70, 71, and pretty much everyone there was on the left. We had all been either editors of our college papers or something, somehow committed to leftist journalism by then, and entered into, and I very quickly saw that it was the opposite of a disadvantage in mainstream journalism to be on the left. This was true even then. I had no trouble getting hired by a mainstream New York magazine. And then came Watergate. So we were all anti-Nixon, and we indulged in that. And that became the big furor. Of course, by then, Woodward and Bernstein were the model for every young journalist. So I remained that way until I got married, really. My wife was kind of a contrary to start with. Now, she had gone to Berkeley during those years and was also on the left. But she was also never accepted a lot of premise, and nor had I really. I always thought a lot of people on the left were stupid and overly dramatic and essentially interested in calling attention to themselves and advancing themselves in any number of ways. Anyway, right when I was first dating my wife, I was following up her up the stairs to my fourth floor walk up. And kind of, you know, looking at her from behind, enjoying the sight. And I was telling her how many of my closest friends were women. That which was true. And I said, it's so much easier to talk to women than it is to male friends. You know, you can talk more honestly about all kinds of things. And she wheeled on me and said, "That old line, come on." And I realized, I cracked up. And I realized this is someone who could really be of interest to me. And so we very shortly thereafter, we got married, had a child very soon thereafter. And she decided, at the time she was an executive with a film company, Columbia Pictures. And she, unlike everyone else in our circle, decided to stay home with our child and became kind of a pariah in her group. No one would, you know, they were all kind of, a lot of women were very threatened by this and clearly felt a certain ambivalence themselves, but couldn't acknowledge it. At the time, my wife had actually joined a group called Women Against Right-Wing Scum, Women in Media Against Right-Wing Scum. And she said, within about 8 months, she realized that she was the right-wing scum that they were talking about at these meetings. And in my own case, at the time I was doing a column for Esquire, and at a certain point I was approached by the editor. They were doing a special women's issue, and did I have anything I was interested in writing about? And I said, how about writing about daycare and whether it's really in the best interests of the child if you can afford not to put your child in daycare? And he, who was unmarried and childless, said, does anyone really care about that? I said, yeah, I think a lot of people do. So I write this piece. It was a research piece, you know, really accepted both sides, although I certainly had my feelings about it. But in the course of it, I raised a lot of objections to daycare. And I actually quoted, first I called Dr. Spock, whom I had interviewed earlier on something else. And Spock said to me, you know, I actually have problems with daycare for a small child, but this is off the record, right? And that should have been the warning flare right there.
Oh boy.
Someone else I interviewed who did allow himself to be quoted was Jonas Salk's brother, Lee Salk, who was a very eminent child psychologist. And the quote that I used in the piece was, "I love dogs, but I would never have a large dog in a New York City apartment because I don't think it's fair to the dog. I think someone who can afford to stay home with his child, with her child, and chooses not to, should have put off having children." And so this piece appears, and I expect it, as a good liberal, to generate all kinds of conversations. Instead, I got this torrent of hate mail. Now, I'd been doing a very popular column and gotten only rapturous mail prior to that, a column called Ethics. Suddenly, I was, you know, villain number one on the part, a feminist villain number one. That was really a major eye-opener for me when I began to appreciate how intolerant people on our side were. There are other things across the way. I was doing a piece down in Florida and hanging around on a baseball field, actually, with a guy having a really good conversation. And I said, who are you with? He said, I'm with the Christian Broadcasting Network. I'd never met anyone outside of my circle, really, who seemed like such a reasonable, nice guy. But the real culmination of it was, as I was drifting in this direction, after the 84 election, the Reagan re-election, I solicited a piece from the New York Times Sunday Magazine, for whom I was still writing quite a bit then. And the piece was essentially about my doubts about the left and about the Democratic Party. And the premise was why it was that we on the left had surrendered the so-called values issues to the right. And in the course of that piece, I talked to a lot of people on the right. I went down to Washington. I met all of Reagan's people, not Reagan himself, unfortunately, but a lot of the people around him, his campaign manager and a lot of his top people. And I found not only were they congenial as individuals, but I was much closer to their point of view than I was to people I knew. And that was really, what was interesting about that piece was the form of the piece was to take a controversial issue, abortion, for example, and interview someone who was otherwise on the left, but had broken with the left. In that case, it was Nat Hentoff, or it started out as Nat Hentoff. Then it turned out when I turned in the piece, my editor at the Times Magazine said, well, Abe Rosenthal doesn't like Nat Hentoff. He's not allowed to appear in the paper. Find someone else. Oh. That's what you need to know about the sainted Abe Rosenthal. But I talked to Glenn Lowry about affirmative action. I spoke to a number of people. I spoke to Tipper Gore, actually, who was, if you recall, leading that thing about labeling
censorship of the
censorship. But what? So I got all these people in the piece. I essentially said what I wanted to. I thought it was the exact right place for that piece. It would open everyone's eyes. I was going to save liberalism. Instead, there was zero reaction. And that was another real insight, that these people cannot bear or are so unused to hearing another point of view. They simply could not hear it. No one understood what I was saying in that piece or that it might apply to them. It was amazing. A remarkable non-reaction.
It's amazing. We're now reaping and that's back then, you know, when we were sort of supposedly in the ascendancy. And now we're just sort of reaping the whirlwind of absolute intolerance and just vitriol. And it even gets to the point of calls for violence against people for just merely stating an opposite opinion. That is just, we're in such a dangerous place with that. It's just, it's beyond belief.
Right. But that's fascinating. What Harry said, you know, 1984, he asked, why did the left surrender values to the right? Well, perhaps in 1984 they did, but fast forward to 2022, and the left has been assiduously working to recapture the values argument from the right. And I think they've done a very good job. You know, the insanity that calling a biological man a woman and then demanding that it be accepted because it's simply the human thing to do is taking that values argument and turning it on its head. But the left has done a very good job of that.
Right. I mean, I should clarify a bit what I said, which was the left always, back when I was writing that piece, the left took the values arguments as phony. And I remember one of Reagan's people said, you know, they all think that Reagan just mouths these things to get votes. They don't understand that people understand that he means them. And so do they. And these things are important in their lives. For the left, it was all at that point, economic issues was, you know, basically. But you're absolutely right, of course. Although I do think the transgender thing is working so much to our advantage that I'm delighted that they've pulled that. I mean, you know, and until they go back to NAMBLA, which is probably their next step. And that man, boy, love.
Well, that's happening. That's happening now. There was somebody got excoriated. I forgot who wanted to redefine. Basically,
yeah, I saw that.
I forgot. I forgot who it was. It was either a professor somewhere.
It was a professor.
But you know, that's all good. That's all good. I think the gay argument was about it. Maybe I'm wrong. I mean, because I
Well, I was going to say, is it all good? Because as I think it was the late Rush Limbaugh, hard to say the late Rush Limbaugh, but Rush Limbaugh said, 20 years ago, did you even think that there was going to be such a thing as gay marriage? And the first person or people who put it out there were ripped a new one. And then look, within 10 years, there's gay marriage. So it's like they put it out there into the atmosphere to see what the reaction is. But by the act of just putting it out there, it sort of gives birth to the nugget of it.
This is the Overton window. They're shifting the Overton window, by millimeters at a time.
Thank you, CBD. Yes, exactly.
Well, this whole thing about transgender women, like Leah Thompson, is that him? Will Thomas.
Yes.
Will Thomas, yeah.
John Thomas.
You refuse to make the news, and I approve. That has mobilized people who ordinarily would never have noticed or been involved. When you go after people's kids, it changes the whole argument, as we saw in Virginia. So at least we can be hopeful. And we can also be hopeful that a lot of eyes have been opened in general since Biden's been in office. I mean, it isn't only that the inflation and the fact that the United States is suddenly a third world power. It's just the sense that things are so awful that beyond what anyone could have conceived of. I think I was talking to a guy yesterday who's actually very hopeful. He says, this is the time when Americans begin to fight. And maybe that's true. I'm a confirmed pessimist, but it was very heartening to hear that.
Harry, I'd like you to hold that thought, but let's take a break and return to that point.
And we're back, Cutjib Newsletter Speaks podcast, episode 15 with CBD and our special guest, Harry Stein. And I think, CBD, you wanted to ask Harry a little bit more about Harry's sort of conversion.
Yes, we drifted away from your conversion story, and I'm fascinated by it because I have experienced similar things, not quite from the far left to the far right. And I certainly know people who have moved in similar ways. So we're at 1984. Right. And
I can just interject because I know Harry has a wonderful book called How I Accidentally Joined the Vast Right Wing Conspiracy and Found Inner Peace. Say that three times fast. And it's your sort of introductory moment when you were, I think it was on the Today Show. I think that's I read that and I sort of my jaw dropped when that was one thing. Maybe that's not the nugget, but go ahead anyway.
Yeah, that was a different story. It was a good story, but it did not involve politics. It involved when I was doing the ethics column, and which again was extremely popular, and I was on with Jane Pauley, who I had known a little bit socially. I'd had dinner with her at a dinner party once, and so we were exchanging chit chat, and then the red light goes on, and she says, "Harry Stein is doing a column called Ethics in Esquire, magazine. Come on," was her opening line. Mom, and I said, "Well, I'm sure you're not proud of everything at NBC either." I said, and I did get excoriated by the editor-in-chief of the magazine for that. But yeah, I thought it was a pretty good comeback. But the I was kind of gradually drifting to the right, not in any kind of meaningful way in that I was writing about it particularly. But for example, when the affirmative action vote in California occurred, I think it was 92 or 93, the Ward Connerly. I was very involved in that program and subsequently became very close friends with Ward and got involved in his movement. So I was thinking these things, and people in my circle became aware, to their surprise in most cases, that I was thinking these things. And I must say, my wife came along with me every step of the way, in certain respects was ahead of me. And it culminated with a book deal I had actually with a mainstream house, that the first book of which was a medical thriller. And I was obligated to write two other thrillers, which I didn't particularly have much interest in writing. So we started talking politics, my editor and I over the table discussing this third book. And I could see her eyes getting wider. And she said, you know, how did you become a, the word was forming on her lips was fascist. But she was too polite to say it. And she was a friend. And I said, maybe I should do that as the third book to fulfill the contract. And that became how I accidentally joined the Vast Radical Conspiracy and found Inner Peace. Now, as the title suggests, I tried to have some fun with it. It was a serious book, essentially, but it was all, but also I didn't want to be a scold. My interest was in bringing other people over who had the same kind of doubts that I had. And another eye-opener, which would not be an eye-opener now, was that although the book did very well, it was almost entirely conservatives who read it. Liberals were not interested in hearing those arguments, were not interested in any kind of self-questioning. There were exceptions. I mean, Andrew Breitbart, who I met subsequently at a party, told me the book had been a big influence on him, which makes me very proud, although I subsequently saw interviews with him in which he talked about other influences, so I don't know how true that was. But after that, I was kind of pegged. I mean, that book, Fox was just starting around that time, and you could basically walk onto the set at any time. And I did a lot of publicity on Fox for that book. I got a lot of attention on the right. It did finally get a very brief and favorable Sunday magazine review in the Times Book Review. I guess that's the last book I ever had reviewed there.
I would imagine so, yes.
Yeah.
All things considered. You know, after that, my whole career changed. I mean, obviously my worldview was already there, but, you know, the left being very exclusionary. And anyway, that's kind of what I wanted to write about. It was what most interested me, politics and the way the left was affecting and already in my mind destroying America. And, you know, it's tough to swim upstream against that. I mean, immediately you're no longer playing in the same league. And it was strange. I was recruited around that time by Manhattan Institute. And I remember everyone was always surprised. I mean, Manhattan Institute had some powerhouse people already. I mean, Heather McDonald was already there. A number of people like that. And none of them had ever been on the Today Show or any of these network shows, which I always went on when I had a book. But their books were being published in very small amounts by conservative houses. And, you know, I eventually drifted over to Roger Kimball's house, Encounter, and Roger's become a very good friend. I mean, people on the right were smarter. They were more open to conversation, to different ideas. It was just a whole different world. But there were also penalties, certainly professional penalties.
You know, I think that's true. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's just, how do you, you know, it's a sad state of affairs where, I mean, yes, there was always strident, it was becoming more strident, I mean, through the 60s, 70s, 80s, but at least you sort of had, you know, there were avenues of communication that were open, or at least there wasn't things that weren't closed to you because it just wasn't the case. But you now have complete polarization, and unfortunately the people of the left do control the media such as it is, at least the mainstream aspect of it. But so thank God there is an alternative media such as the internet and talk radio and so on and so forth. But how does one reach these kind of people, whether it's, you know, just your standard, whether it's a low information voter who really doesn't know what's going on, or whether it is a leftist, quote unquote, or is it such a fundamentalist religion that you just can't break through to people and just sort of give it up, throw your hands up and say it's a lost cause?
I don't think you reach those people. I do think that there are many, many people who are reachable, as you say, that they're either low information or kind of, there are a few people. I'm thinking of my kind of old left-wing friends of whom I still have a couple left. We've basically stopped talking over the last couple of years because it's just too charged. And that really began with Trump. I mean, prior to Trump, during the Obama years in particular, there were certain people who kind of liked having someone like me as a friend because it showed how open-minded they were. And they could kind of smile and you know, kind of pat you on the head. And once we had some kind of power, and once policies, and once above all, we were supporting Trump, we were persona non grata. That was a whole different thing. I mean, some of my closest friends, one of the woman friends who had been a friend prior to Priscilla, who I was talking about going up the stairway that time, finally said to me, I cannot have anything more to do with you. Oh, she said this openly to me. I'm just too angry. And she is and was.
I've had nothing. I think that the true believers, you know, the margins out at maybe 5% on either end can never be converted.
No.
I think that there is, for instance, you mentioned some of the cultural changes in the United States, the transgender ridiculousness. That's the kind of stuff that will convert people to a more rational right of center worldview. But there is no way to convert the true believer.
Well, most people do not have politics in the center of their lives. They don't, you know, either they're too busy and they have other preoccupations, or they don't realize how important it is until it's too late. You know, someone was making the point about, right, last week it was, can't remember who, I thought it was Michael Walsh, but maybe not, about the numbers for Fox and the numbers for MSNBC and CNN versus the numbers for mainstream programming, which dwarf you know, if you take all the people who watch Tucker and all the people who watch Hannity and all the rest of them, Laura Ingraham, you know, it seems like a lot compared to the other cable networks, but compared to real life, it's zero.
Yeah, you know, the Thursday night rerun on primetime of a sitcom is going to draw 20 times that audience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. How do you reach those people? And those people, of course, in general, are being influenced by the content of what they're watching, which is subtly left or not so subtly left all the time anyway. How do you reach those people? I think you reach those people when it hits them personally. And that's where the transgender athlete stuff helps us. And certainly where the policies of the Biden administration in general help us.
Well,
absolutely correct.
Yeah, I was going to say is we don't, you know, until, you know, now all of a sudden look at the economy. I mean, we're heading for Weimar Germany or Zimbabwe or whatever it is. And when it gets that serious, then, you know, people will be taken to the streets. Usually it's, you know, protesting is for the, you know, the Robert Kramer crowd who, you know, the rent-a-mobs from the Occupy Wall Street and so on and so forth and Antifa. But when you're out of a job and when gasoline is $30 a gallon and when there's food shortages, well, people will have nothing left to do than to, shall we say, vent their anger in the streets. And it's not going to be pretty. And there's a hell of a lot more of us in that regard than there are of the other side.
It's an interesting case. I mean, you know, you don't know how many of those people are going to be Bernie people. You just don't know. I mean that was the situation in 1930 and 31, 32, and the kids were all on the left, and it's likely to be that way again. I mean, you're not going to have, you know, laid off GM workers out in the streets the same way you do college kids.
One of the problems with Republican Party in the United States is that they don't take advantage of the opportunities that they are afforded. I wrote about this morning. Governor Holcomb in Indiana refused to sign an anti-trans athlete bill. Yeah. And it would have been a layup. It would have been an easy way to expose the left, to show Indiana and America that there are certain cultural norms that we are going to respect and that they are important. He chose not to do it. And it was a huge, perhaps not a huge mistake, but it was a mistake because it was so easy to make the point. Yeah. And he chose not to for reasons that we don't need to go into.
That a fear of even that. Well, this of course leads to DeSantis, who is for many of us, exactly like the last best hope. If I were DeSantis, I would take Putin-like precautions. I would have people, I would have a food taster. I would sit at that desk 12 feet from everybody, maybe not even see his family.
If a guy with an eye patch and a briefcase walks in, make sure you're on the other side of the table.
And an umbrella.
The fact that the left is working so hard to make sure that Trump can't run again is a typical bit of leftist idiocy. Because DeSantis has is exactly the opposite of what you're describing in Holcomb. He embraces these fights and is great at fighting them and is as smart as anyone.
It's funny you mentioned Indiana with Holcomb. It's like, well, look who came from Indiana. That was Mike Pence, and look who had the chance to. And you know, he introduces RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and then as soon as somebody said boo, we said, oh, I'm sorry, and they pulled it, and it was a chance to really, you know, score. But of course, he wimped out, and I don't know if it's an Indiana thing but it certainly is a GOP establishment thing where they're not going to fight it, and they're going to let the narrative and let the culture war narrative just go on and cower away from it. And they shouldn't. It is a layup. It's say, look, this is freakish. A man posing as a woman and winning things. It's insanity. And you can't not oppose that. And DeSantis, I think, is the man. You know, the other thing, Harry, you mentioned about with Trump, you know, or with him being the last best hope. I have a feeling, and I hope it's the case. I think it's a head fake. I don't think Trump is going to run. I think he's gonna hopefully become the titular head or the spiritual head of the MAGA movement, and I think that is the ideal position for him. I think great communicator. He had his time. He had his chance to do it, and he did what he did, which was amazing that he did do what he did do. But his failings and his Achilles heel and not seeing the enemies around him is just something that I think that, and plus the left's attack against him is something that.
Something Harry just brought it up. I think it's vitally important that we allow the left to demonize Trump right up until November 2024. That's fine. My personal opinion is that he should not run. Number one, he's too old. Number two, he's too prickly. Number three, his political skill is woefully lacking. Let the left fire everything they have at Donald Trump, and we will have a President DeSantis on January 20th. 2025.
I absolutely hope you're right. And who knows? I mean, Trump's personality, you can't tell which direction he'll go. I mean, he might have an almost physical need to vindicate himself. I've sensed from him lately too that same kind of hesitation. I think he's scared of DeSantis for one thing. He doesn't want, I think if DeSantis went head to head against him, DeSantis would beat him. The more exposure DeSantis had, the contrast would be so great. And essentially, the policy-wise, they're identical. So I think DeSantis would play very well if he took that lead.
I agree. This is quite odd. We have three New York communists who have had a sea change and are now three
funny,
ardent DeSantis supporters.
My family history was, at least not my mother's side, but on my father's side, he grew up in Chicago, and my grandfather was IWW, the whole thing. I think it, but although Wobbly. He was one of the Wobblies. I think though he wasn't Workman's Circle. I think though somebody brought home members of the Lincoln Brigade to have dinner, and I think my grandfather or somebody freaked out. They're going, "Oh my God, the FBI is gonna raid the place." So we are. We do share that lineage, and it's just,
interestingly enough, that book that I was planning to write all those years ago about the Communist Party, I interviewed a friend of my parents who was in the Lincoln Brigade.
Oh,
and I actually just listened to that tape not long ago. It's incredible. I mean, those guys were amazingly brave, but they were hardcore, really hardcore Stalinists.
You know, it's funny, the parallels in a way with, dare I say it, with, because I'll get in trouble with Putin and with Zelensky, you know, and then the Spanish Civil War. It's just, look, you know, I don't root for Hitler, and I don't root for Stalin, but the fact of the matter is, it's, you know, the Stalinists were at least that were in Spain, from what I understand, were horrendous, and they were going to bring hell on their own people, and it was Franco who, you know, who stood up to them. And not that he's a great man or anything like that, or he's also a tyrant and a dictator, but you know, it's like it's the devil in the deep blue sea. And just the fact that Hitler was involved in supporting him was, that sort of taints the record of why he did what he did. But at the same token, it's just, crazy.
You know, there was a guy named Eugene Lyons. You ever hear of him?
Not offhand. I have to plead the fifth on that.
He was a fairly prominent journalist in the 20s and 30s. He was He was on the left. I don't think he ever joined the party, but he was a real sympathizer. And UPI sent him to Moscow as their first correspondent, as their lead correspondent during the Stalin era. And he got the first Western interview with Stalin, was kind of celebrated. And while in the Soviet Union, began to have his eyes open. You know, to his everlasting shame, he did not speak up about the famine any more than Walter Duranty did.
But he covered it up, but, you know, Duranty.
But he was eventually, he tried to get anti-Stalin dispatches out of the Soviet Union, was eventually thrown out, came back to this country, saw what was happening in this country under the New Deal, how the government had been infiltrated by leftist sympathizers, and particularly how Hollywood was being in it. And he wrote a book called The Red Decade, which was published on the eve, actually, of the Nazi invasion of Russia, which is an absolutely fabulous book about all of this, about having one's eyes open, but particularly about the takeover of American culture by the left, even then, not to the same degree, largely because business and religion were still kind of immune to that, but to a remarkable degree, and particularly journalism. And
so, you know, it's the long march, basically, and it's a very long march because it's a continuum. It's not just isolated incidents, but, you know, if you want to go back to 1913 when Woodrow Wilson, when they passed the 16th Amendment, doing away with the, you know, they had direct elections of the Senate, and then all of a sudden the New Deal became turning limited government on its ear, and that was the beginning of it all. And then gradually, slowly but surely, here we are today, where there is no, you know, I lamented it today. It's like we have this Ketanji Jackson, Brown Jackson, whatever her name is, being up for the seat that was vacated by Stephen Breyer. And I'm, you know, normally I'd get crazy. I'd say, oh my God, these people are out of their minds, and look who we're about to put on the Supreme Court. And I'm saying to myself, does it really freaking matter? Are we so far gone that what does it matter if they seat her or not? Or if they don't seat her, they'll find another one to take her place. But I mean, you know, our government is so corrupted, and we're ruled essentially by a bureaucracy, and we have feral law enforcement and intelligence agencies that are throwing people in basically political prisons for having the wrong political views, that are we so far gone that even that doesn't matter, or even God forbid elections don't matter anymore? It's just,
we have to fight though. This is a discussion that I've had with friends, and some have disagreed that the current fight in the Senate, what is the committee?
Judiciary, I guess.
Yeah, the Senate Judiciary Committee is going to be ultimately of no worth, but that's not the case. We have to fight simply for the sake of pushing back. And yes, we're going to lose. And if it isn't Ketanji, it's going to be some other lunatic who will vote the same way on every single case. But we have to show that we are willing to put up or shut up.
Well, you know, part of my antipathy was the fact that, look what, you know, we talked about Donald Trump. He got Brett Kavanaugh, and he got Amy Coney Barrett, and he got Neil Gorsuch to the, you know, nominated, and everyone was, you know, shouting with glee, hooray, we finally have a majority, if not for John, you know, John Roberts, we have a majority, at least 5-4 of, you know, conservatives, or at least a semi people who were supposedly originalist or, you know, strict constructionists or whatever. And then they do also forget about even the vote of to, you know, for over the election, or to even hear the case, no standing, as Roberts said. Other issues like the I think it was the vaccine mandate where.
Yeah, the vaccine mandate.
Kavanaugh and Roberts joined with the liberals, and they—I mean,
yeah.
So that's why I have this sort of antipathy about things. But you are right; we do have to fight. It has to be, you know. And then someone blasted me because they said, "Well, you know, we're tired of having moral victories when we're being, you know, sent to the gulag." I mean, what is that going to do for us? But I guess maybe it is something. Maybe there is a sea. It is a harbinger of something that's other than just a moral victory.
And I will frankly take our 5-4 majority for what it's worth, because it is worth something. I was actually far more concerned about news that Clarence Thomas was in the hospital for his infection.
Oh, yeah. My God.
Than anything happening in the Judiciary Committee.
Exactly.
And you're right. That's a given. They'll all vote the same way. And the fact that people on our side swing both ways, you know, actually speaks well for at least some of these people that they are open to argument. and that they that their interpretation of the Constitution is such that they render these decisions foolish as we may think they are.
Right. I don't. It speaks, though, Harry, to another problem that I have in that, you know, we tend to play by the Marquis of Queensbury rules, whereas they've completely thrown the rule book out, and now they burned the rule book, and they're now in the process of burning the stadium with us in the audience. So
we've got more and more of those kinds of people on our side, more and more, and there'll be more after this election. I mean, Josh Hawley is pretty good. We've got some people who will fight now, who would have been unheard of 10, 20 years ago.
Right.
And I remember actually when I first did the Right Wing Conspiracy book, I was invited down to David Horowitz's annual retreat in Florida. Right. And he gave a talk about his conversion. And when he came over to the right, he was surprised at how polite and nice everyone was. And he said, you know, you people have to understand what you're dealing with. You're dealing with gutter fighters. And until we learn to be gutter fighters also, we're not going to have a chance against these people. And I think we do have some pretty, I mean, Trump, obviously, but we have others, too, who are a lot tougher than people were a generation ago.
I think Trump has forced the left's hand. They have taken their gloves off, and their right. True character is being shown more and more. And I think that's important. And I think that's a very, very good thing. You know, you mentioned that your wife went to Berkeley. I went there also. And I lived my first year at a student cooperative, a very large three-story building that was a sewer, but was quite interesting. And we had what we called a graffiti wall, where people would write political statements. And one of my acquaintances wrote something about People's Park, which was a 2-acre lot in the middle of Berkeley that should have been the site of dormitories, because Berkeley is famous for having far less student housing than it needs. But the hippies and the street people took over People's Park, and it turned into a cause célèbre, and had been for 10 years. That's anyway, she wrote something, you know, she was one of these soft socialists that I knew too many of. She wrote something silly about People's Park, how it's such a beautiful place and how wonderful it is. Yeah, it's a beautiful place if you wanted to go buy heroin or get mugged. Anyway, I wrote below it, People's Park, : nuke it, pave it, build a dorm. And I signed it. And a couple of hours later, she came up to me in tears because she had never been confronted. She had never been confronted with the idea that somebody disagreed with her and was going to say something about it. And the Republican Party nowadays is possibly shifting away from that that collegial, oh, let's not fight about anything. Even if we're losing, we're not going to fight. We're not going to push. We just need to get along. And DeSantis is one of them. Hawley is one of them. Marjorie Taylor Greene is another. There are probably a list of 10 or 15 more. And if that occurs, we have a chance. But if it doesn't, if these people are flash in the pan, I don't see how we can dig ourselves out of the mess that we are in right now.
You know, where I think we do have a chance is, you know, at the local level, at the school board level, as we have seen, because now school board members who speak up are potential enemies of the state, and elsewhere, and people who go to community board meetings as well. There was a gentleman, I forgot, and he just got elected to Congress the last time around, who gave this impassioned speech about the Second Amendment and defending, you know, against rioters and so on and so forth in South Carolina. And he ran and he got elected.
But he beyond was lieutenant governor.
The lieutenant governor. Excuse me. I'm sorry. Yeah, I forget his name, and I apologize.
He's a fine man, and he's incredibly articulate.
But that's
vehement and passionate.
Yeah, and that's where it's going to be won and lost. It's yes to obviously at the national, at the state level and local level, but certainly at the local level, where it's really personal, schools and community boards, and just every day and dealing with people. And as you said last week when we were talking with Michael Walsh, it's just, you know, forget it. You know, you got to punch people in the face, so to speak, you know, whether it's rhetorically speaking or just saying, no, as I said at the beginning of this one, I said, forget it. You got to reject. I reject what you say, and I outright, out of hand. It's ridiculous. Now let's talk about reality and go from there. That's how you're going to win it.
By the way, I apologize. It's North Carolina, and the gentleman's name is Lieutenant Governor Mark K. Robinson.
That's
a
it.
Fine absolutely. Man.
Funny, Harry, when I asked Harry to join us, he says, you know, and God bless you, I assiduously avoid looking at the news because it's too damn depressing. And I don't think you've looked at anything for at least since 2020. I'm not sure. But and Harry is along with being a fine writer in his own right, he edited my book, The End of America, which is basically a chronicle of all the days that you so wanted to avoid.
Those
reading.
Are the days I missed. I stopped after the election for about 4 or 5 months. Okay. I just couldn't bear to see this guy inaugurated. I couldn't, you know. So January 6th, I kind of dimly heard about it because it was impossible to avoid, but I really caught up, you know, after the fact.
And we have returned for one final bonus segment with CBD and Harry Stein, our special guest on the Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks podcast. I think we wanted to discuss a very mild and non-controversial topic at all, race in America. Because well, we have the upcoming the confirmation hearing of Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court. I flabbergasted everybody.
You know, it is flabbergasting. We fall silent. When I was promoting that book, no matter what they'll call this book, racist, I was interviewed by, of all people, Rush Limbaugh. And I had met Rush before, but that's another story. But he got on the phone prior to the interview, because it was for the Limbaugh newsletter. He sounded so different than we were used to hearing him on the radio. He said, you know, there's no solution to this, is there? I mean, I've tried, I've talked, I've thought about it so much. I mean, he sounded so sad and almost so beaten on this issue. And, I don't know what I said. I mean, because basically I agreed with him, because I don't know how we ever solve this issue. We've talked about peeling off black vote, a certain rising understanding in at least parts of the black community of how destructive Democratic Party is and how they've been exploited and to the detriment of themselves and the country. There is some small understanding. I mean, you have people like Candace Owens and others. You've had Tom Sowell forever and people like that, Ward Conroy. I don't know. I think
the solution is not social. I think it's economic. And we can just look back to the 1960s for proof. Before the Great Society, Black America was entering the middle class at a tremendous rate. Blacks were entering college, going from bus drivers. Their kids were becoming accountants and physicians and lawyers. The raw numbers were very, very small, but the rate of increase was fantastic. And the Great Society not only stopped that, it reversed it. And I think that is the only way to solve the issue of race in America, and that is make every race middle class. I mean, that sounds ridiculous.
I think that's part of it, and you're absolutely right. And I actually wrote about that at some length in the book. But of course, at that time, the Democratic Party was blacks were as Democratic as they are in their affiliation as they are today. I was talking with Brian Anderson over at City Journal about this. And the one thing we agree on was you have to stop lowering standards. You must hold everyone accountable to exactly the same standards. I mean, that is a death pit once you have a two-tier society, even successful blacks are going to be presumed to be deficient. I mean, John McWhorter writes about this and others too. And this I think is the vital question. I think we get rid of affirmative action. We get rid of any semblance of affirmative action. We stop talking about it. If people fail, I mean, what was interesting with the California proposition that Connerly led back in the 90s was, well, you know this as a Berkeley grad, it did change the numbers of blacks who were admitted to Berkeley.
Yes. It dropped yes.
It went from something like 6% to 2.5%. I mean, it was a major drop. However, the graduation rate increased exponentially, and the kids who otherwise were admitted to Berkeley were now admitted to the California state system, and their graduation rates, rather than being failures at Berkeley, they were successful at the level at which they could achieve the level they had earned. I mean, that to me is the fundamental lesson. And of course, the left never acknowledges that. They only talk about the input rates, never the output rate. So that is, I think, a winning argument. I think that's understood. And I don't think people like to be condescended to. You know, my wife always quotes a letter she saw in the New York Times when it was about the Harvard Law Journal written by some black guy. And they were now moving to, he had been on the Harvard Law Journal when he was in school, but now they were using affirmative action there. And he said, please don't take that away from me. Please don't take that achievement away from me. I mean, it's very poignant because it is so dehumanizing what the left does to black people. Their contempt and their condescension.
Well, that to me is, I think, as CBD alluded to when you talked about the fact that they were on their way to being integrated fully into society, both in the middle class and economically as well as socially. That was happening. It was inevitable after World War II. Yes, there were fits and starts in the Klan and all this kind of stuff, who are Democrats, by the way, was happening. But the one thing that they recognized was that when they joined the middle class and they're not dependent on government anymore, well, that's the problem. Then all of a sudden the Democrats lose their power base. And that's why they created the
group. It wasn't changing the numbers. It wasn't. Democrats were looked at as the good guys. I mean, yeah. Get it back to,
which is weird, but because it was the Republicans that spurred on the Civil Rights Act and all these things.
I mean, why are Jews voting the way we are?
That's a whole other story. That
you know, it has nothing to do with logic at all.
No.
But Thomas Sowell tells a story about going to what was, I guess, even then an all-black high school in Washington D.C., Dunbar High School, which had the highest achievement rates in the city at the time, higher than the white high schools. And again, before integration, really. But, you know, so there is, I think, this pervasive notion that blacks are incapable of achieving. And that has to be done away with entirely. And the only way to do away with it is to do away with it and make everyone compete on an equal level. And if people don't succeed, well, you try to give as much help as you can at the beginning. You realize the black family is largely dysfunctional. The inner city, all those problems we don't have to enumerate. But you never lower the standard.
Right. The problem is, though, that the blame for that is always cast on America as founded, which is a racist society, and it's white people that are keeping black people down.
Well, so, I mean, Sowell's argument counters that. I mean, and the fact that, yes, blacks were rising prior to the – and black, two-parent families – were almost comparable to white two-parent families then. I mean, it really has been since the Great Society that the black family has disintegrated.
That to me, is I think that's one of the greatest crimes ever committed in this country. I mean,
and by the way, the black family was simply the first. White families are disintegrating now also. The left has done a fine, fine job of destroying traditional society in America.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is that the problem is when Harry was talking about, if you go to a doctor's office and you see a black doctor, I mean, you're going to wonder whether you want to or not, you're going to wonder in the back of your mind, is this guy or gal competent, or did they get there because they were, socially promoted because of the color of their skin? You know, that's just now what's happening now is you have all these corporations. It's not just the government, but you have the it's diversity, inclusion, and equity. You're not diversity, equity, and inclusion. Officers in all these companies that are bean counters that are hiring people just based on these on these, color of skin, sexuality, gender, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing to do with competence. And it's not even the government that's doing it anymore. It's society in general that's doing this. And that's a real challenge.
You know, it's interesting. You've probably seen the old Larry David show where he addresses that.
Didn't they ban that, I think, or they were trying to ban that?
Because it was toward the beginning of the show where he's kind of walking along. He runs into Richard Lewis and they're chatting on the sidewalk. And Lewis's black doctor jogs by and stops to talk to them. And Larry David says, "Doctor? I mean, the affirmative action thing?" I mean, which no one on the right could ever say.
No. But
David, of course, got away with it. But it's the kind of thing that we have to say all the time. We have to talk honestly about everything, about what the left has done to racial relations on that kind of level.
Yeah.
That in fact, we do not trust a black pilot to fly our plane, or we at least have that concern, that momentary passing concern. And that will only change when we change the way we do things.
Well, it's funny. My mother, rest in peace, a Hungarian immigrant who became an English teacher in the black neighborhood in Brooklyn. She actually had that experience. I mean, I think she and my dad were going on vacation, get on an airplane, and everywhere my mother goes, they always used to say, "Yo, it's Mrs. So-and-so, Mrs. So-and-so, how you doing?" And she sees a cop, or she sees whoever. And it's, "And nice to see you, how you doing," whatever. So anyway, they're getting on an airplane, they're going to Europe on a vacation, and she hears, "Yo, Mrs. And she turns around, and there's a co-pilot or the pilot, and it's one of her former students. And as she said, not exactly the sharpest tool in the shed, but but she said, I assume he knows how to fly the plane,
right.
So I take it. So she took it as a compliment. Maybe her teaching helped this guy, achieve, which I always like to think positively that way as well, because she, unlike so many teachers these days, she actually gave a damn about her students. And, she didn't, even though she was in one of the worst schools, if not the worst high school in New York City, where a third of the kids never showed up because they were criminals. A third were just unfortunate and had poor situations, but they wanted to learn. And the other third were just out of their minds. She tried to save as many lives as she can. So there is that. But anyway, the plane landed safely, by the way, and all was well.
Well, what's happened to the teaching profession? Let's not get into that.
Gentlemen, I think we're going to call it here, because it's been a phenomenal, phenomenal almost hour of just great chatting. CBD, thank you. Harry Stein, thanks so much for sharing your life stories and insights, and hopefully better days ahead as you actually brave watching the news for a change.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, for having me. It's been a pleasure.
It has been a pleasure. Harry, it was a pleasure meeting you.
Same here.
This has been the Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks podcast. We will, episode 15. March 22nd, 2022. See you in the funny papers, folks. Ciao.
Thanks for listening, folks.